Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, before we talk about this reflection area for visitors, give us some insight. Take us back. Talk about the history of the John Dickinson Plantation.
Sure. Well, the land was expanded over time by the Dickinson family. It was originally purchased by John Dickinson's father, and so he moved there as a boy from Maryland. And ultimately, he and his brother inherited the land, and the John Dickinson Plantation, the area that John owned, grew to be about 5,000 acres over time. We don't have 5,000 acres there. We have just under 450 acres. And so if people are familiar with our neighbor just to the east, that is the St. Jones Reserve, all of that area would have originally been part of the plantation. So all the way over to Route 1 and then basically all the way over to the Delaware River. So it was a very large area, and we have a portion of it. John Dickinson spoke very passionately and wrote very passionately for American independence, although he had a little bit of a dichotomy there, because he didn't think it was time to split from the British, so he lost some favor there, although ultimately, once that decision was made, he did decide to go ahead and enlist, and he did fight in the Revolutionary War. He was a very popular figure in his day, and he ended up becoming one of the early governors of Delaware, although he didn't stay governor of Delaware for all that long, because then Pennsylvania invited him to be the governor of Pennsylvania. And so he left Delaware and went up to Pennsylvania and became the governor up there. We call this his boyhood home, because he did live here as a boy and as a young man. He went to London to train to be a lawyer. And when he came back, he did visit this area from time to time, but a lot of his adult life was spent living in and around the Philadelphia area.
That's an interesting story in of itself, that he was governor of Delaware and he left to become governor of Pennsylvania. That's a story in itself, right?
It is. There are not many people, I'm not sure if there are any other people, that were governor of two states. And he was very well regarded here in Delaware, even though he didn't really live here. Like I said, most of his adult life, he was not living here in Delaware, but he was still well regarded in the area, and people really looked up to him. And so he was elected, and he had served other elected posts in Delaware, and he did receive that. He did accept it, but it wasn't for too long, because he was also well regarded in Philadelphia. So he went up there, and he became the governor, and you know, people in Delaware maybe weren't too happy about it, but obviously his legacy here in Delaware lives on, so everybody was able to get over it.
Dan, how many people were enslaved on the site of the John Dickinson Plantation?
We're still working on an exact number. Part of the issue with researching people who were enslaved is that their history has been erased, and that is true for any site like this. It is always difficult to be able to say with absolute certainty that we've been able to track down the lives of every single person who were there, just because records were not kept on enslaved individuals by everybody. They weren't always counted in census records as they should have been, and so it is just very, very difficult to be sure. Now, we do have manumission documents, and so those are documents used to free enslaved people from John Dickinson. There's a few of them where he manumitted a few people or a group of people, but in some cases it was they would be free after 20 years more labor or something like that. Ultimately, he did end up freeing everyone who he enslaved, and so there are, I believe, just over 40 names on that list. But even he wanted to make sure he wasn't missing anybody, because at the end of that list, he actually notes, "and anyone else who I may have forgotten," or something to that effect. So even he recognized the fact that these lives and the recording of these lives was lost, even in the moment. So it is, we are trying to piece all of that together, and we do tell the stories of some of the enslaved people that we know on the site, and we are striving to learn even more.
Are there anyone, can we mention some of the names, maybe a more famous person on that site?
As far as enslaved people, you mean?
Yes.
So one of the people that we know a decent amount about, her name is Dinah, and she was enslaved on the plantation. She was ultimately freed, and the manumission document that frees her is in Delaware Public Archives, so we do have a copy of that as well. She ended up marrying a free black man who was a tenant farmer on the site. And so after she gained her freedom, she actually continued living there on the plantation as a tenant farmer herself. And so we do know a fair amount about her. She's mentioned a few times, and then she's listed in some of the tenant contracts with her husband.
All right, just to bring everyone up to speed, we're talking to Dan Citrin. Dan is a historic site team manager at the Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs. We're talking about the John Dickinson Plantation, and now that we've heard the history from Dan, want to move forward a little bit as part of an extensive master plan for enhancing and expanding the visitor experience at the John Dickinson Plantation, which is in Kent County in Dover. The division, the Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, will be creating an area of reflection to allow visitors a quiet place for contemplation after learning more about the lives of those enslaved at the site. Talk about this.
Certainly. We're very excited about the work we're doing out there. Right now, we have what we call the Historic Core, and that's the John Dickinson Mansion, which is a National Historic Landmark, and the area surrounding it. And what happened years ago was we reconstructed some of the agricultural outbuildings, as well as one example of what we call it a logged dwelling. Even though it's not made out of logs, that was a period term for it. It's a wood frame, wood-sided structure. It has no floor. There's a door on either side. It's just one room. And it's really representative of what a lot of people in Kent County would have been living in. The John Dickinson Mansion is a much larger structure. It's made out of brick. It represents what the extremely wealthy would have been living in. So a lot of people, when they see these old houses, they think, oh, this is what everybody was living in, and you know, wasn't this time beautiful? And what a lot of people don't realize is those houses survived because they were the best examples of, from the wealthiest individuals in that area. So the logged dwelling really does represent what a lot of, what most of the population of Kent County would have been living in. Some lived in something not quite as nice, some lived in something a little bit nicer. This building also represents what the enslaved people would have been living in, because these dwellings were scattered throughout the property where people were working. And so for the tenant farmers, they would have had it on the land they were renting. For the enslaved individuals, they would have had them fairly close to the fields they would have been working on, or if they were working in or around the mansion, their dwelling probably would have been closer to the mansion. And so we interpret these areas and talk about the lives of all of the people who lived at the John Dickinson Plantation. With this master plan, we're going to be building a new visitor center, a much larger visitor center, and it's going to have a large exhibit space. Our current visitor center has a small exhibit space that is also our sort of orientation space and a program space and a meeting space. This new visitor center will have all of those separated out, so we can better meet the needs of all of our visitors, and we can have larger school groups and community groups can come in and use the meeting space. So we want it to be a community spot as well as a historic site. Coming out of the visitor center, we're going to have a variety of pathways that explore deeper into the property. So right now, a lot of the property is still used for agriculture, just as it was in John Dickinson's time, although it's modern agriculture. We're going to be taking some of that out of modern agriculture, and part of the time we're going to be doing an archaeological field lab, so we'll have public archaeological programs, and then ultimately we hope to be planting the types of things that we know from John Dickinson's writings were being grown on that land so that we can demonstrate the types of crops that were grown in the time period. These pathways will get people out into the property, into much more of it, going all the way down to the marsh of the St. Jones River and ultimately connecting us with our neighbors, the St. Jones Reserve, so people would be able to then utilize their trail system as well. And this will really not just get people out into the agricultural fields, get them out into nature and out to the marsh, but really get a better perspective of what life was like on this land, because our interpretation and our programming that's going to go along with this is going to be talking about who would have been living out on these areas, who would have been working out in these fields. And it's while we already talk about the people who were enslaved at the John Dickinson plantation, this will be a more well-rounded experience, so people get a better sense of what life was like out there during that time period.
Dan, how long before all of this is completed, and at what kind of a price tag?
We are still evaluating that. We are in the early stages of that part of it, so we're still at the conceptual design, and we're working on getting pricing, and so I can't really answer that part of the question yet. But it's going to be a multi-year project. We are working on finalizing some aspects to do some of the archaeology, because before we put any pathways down, since we would be disturbing the ground to do that, we want to make sure that we're protecting any buried cultural resources. We don't think there's, people hear that and they go, ooh, there's buried treasure out there. And it might be buried treasure to us as historians and archaeologists, but we're not expecting to find, a chest full of gold or anything like that. What we want to find are artifacts that talk about the life of the people who lived out there. So we want to make sure we're protecting all of those resources and we're finding out all of that information that we can. Then the pathways will go out on top of that where we've checked those areas. And so that'll be happening probably in the next 2 years, and with the visitor center to follow.
All right, we can say that the project will be supported in part by a $5,000 grant from the National Trust for Historic Preservation?
That is correct. We are happy to receive a generous grant from the National Trust, and they are funding a program that we are doing jointly with the University of Delaware's Landscape Architecture Program. We wanted to, as part of this master plan, incorporate an area of reflection, because we understand that the topics that we're covering, especially the lives of the people who were enslaved at the site, are very difficult. And they're not just difficult for visitors, they're difficult for us. And, we understand we've had training, our staff has had training and done the research to be presenting this information. And even then, they are still difficult topics, and it can be quite upsetting. So we want to make sure that people have a quiet, appropriate, reflective space on the property so that they can process the information that they've heard and think about it and reflect on it however they see fit. We don't dictate to people how they should feel about it, but we want to make sure they have a space to relax and reflect so that they can think about everything that we're presenting to them.